Welcome to the Confident Retirement Podcast. How confident are you when it comes to life's biggest money decisions? What is real financial peace and how can you get it? Chris Flaming and Mark Peachy are the founders of LPF Advisors in Sarasota, Florida. They bring together the brightest minds to show you how to have a more confident financial future. They empower listeners with common sense concepts and financial wisdom. And now, here are your hosts, LPF Advisors.
I want to welcome everybody to the inaugural economic webinar brought to you by LPF Advisors. I'm your host. Everybody recognizes me, Chris Flaming, and I'm one of the co-owners of the firm. We're so glad that everybody's joining us this morning. Just so everyone's aware, we are recording the webinar. We're going to distribute it later. And we're very excited about our guest today, who I will introduce in a minute. First, a disclaimer written by our attorneys. The information that we're going to go over today is opinion and not necessarily that of our firm or the Zoom platform. We're using this for general education purposes, and it's not any customized recommendations during the session. You should consult with your professional advisors, tax, attorney, or financial or otherwise on your specific situation, and nothing should be construed as advice or recommendations. I think I got that all done in one breath. Okay, today I have the pleasure of welcoming my good friend Phil Blancato to our webinar as our featured panelist. He is president and CEO of Ladenburg Thalmann Asset Management. He's an almost 35-year industry veteran and has been quoted in the Wall Street Journal. He frequently appears on CNBC and Fox Business and is a regular speaker at industry conferences regarding investment management, risk, diversification, and macroeconomic theory. He's also, as I mentioned, a good friend of mine and somebody that I personally admire a lot. Phil, thank you for being here and providing your insight. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. Chris, you're right. Yeah, you are. I look back at you, someone, a dear friend of mine, someone I admire and professionally and personally. You're a special person, no doubt about it.
All right. Thank you. I needed that validation. Okay. You have an interesting, kind of interesting history, your background. Yeah. So maybe just briefly take me through what led you to pursue the industry and brought you to the place that you are right now.
For sure. I'm kind of a bit of the unusual Wall Street person. My mom and dad are both Italian immigrants. I was lucky to grow up in a very close-knit Italian family where everybody's a plumber or a carpenter or something like that. And I was actually going to be a general contractor. That's really what I wanted to do. I wanted to build houses. And then my dad, who didn't have much education, left school in the sixth grade, said, you know, I never had a chance to do that, at least go to school and learn how to run a business. So I decided to go to a local community college. It's a four-year school. But it was a suitcase school drive back and forth called Kane. I played baseball there. I had some fun playing baseball. I was a solidly average baseball player, but had a lot of fun. And then I happened to be there and had a class in macroeconomics one. And suddenly I went, wow, I'm really interested in this. And here I am 34 years later. Don't have the traditional pedigree that most folks have where they're coming out of a New York Institute of Finance or Columbia or some of those bigger schools. I went to Kane, eventually went on to NYU and into Wharton later in my life. But today, lucky enough it's an honor to do what I do. I've been pop out of bed every day, thrilled. I really am overwhelmed by the fact that I get to help folks make money. Today, we manage in excess of $5 billion. I provide investment advice on $700 billion and have a chance to, and I've been doing this for the better part of, as you mentioned, almost 35 years. So very lucky to be involved in macroeconomics, understanding how politics play into economics, mm-hmm. how trends globally and domestically play into it, and then take those trends and put them into a portfolio and then change the portfolio based on what's happening out there. So that's what I get to do. And, luckily enough to have great friends and family as a support system, but also put myself out there in a way that I like to help folks understand what's happening and why we do what we do.
Okay. And I'm going to ask you about macro theory here in a second, but just before we get into that, what do you kind of consider to be your favorite part about what you do?
You know, I think there's a lot of folks out there that you hear the stories about hedge fund titans and how much money they make and the folks at the private equity firms. I luckily took a path where, and I put it this way, sort of the main street person who needs help. So my good fortune is to work with thousands of clients today, 25,000 clients and thousands of advisors. We help the folks who have, a few hundred thousand dollars to a few million dollars to invest. The folks at traditional big Wall Street firms don't care a heck of a lot about. So for me, I am born of a blue collar family, and I'd like to help. I believe I'm helping the blue collar millionaire, and that's a thrill for me to get people to a place in life where they never thought they would achieve, to help them retire better and maybe do things for their families, to help those assets grow. that's a thrill for me. And that's really why I enjoy what I do so much.
Okay. Yeah. It's much like me. It's the relationships. So for people that might not know this already, we talked about macro theory. So maybe give us a 30,000 foot view of what macroeconomic theory is and how that differs from maybe the micro part. Okay.
If you think about John Vogel, you know, the Vanguard, their whole premise was buy some stuff, set it and forget it. And for those of on a call might be a bit older, the 70s, there was only a handful of stocks traded. And then as years went on, we had more and more ability to do different things. And that evolved into, do we move away from set it and forget it, buy 10 stocks, for example, GE, and then never look at it again? Or do we actually look at a portfolio and make changes? So when we look at the macroeconomic environment, basically what's happening in the world, how's China doing? How's Europe doing? How's the United States doing? And at that one level down, if the United States is the leading world economy, how strong is their dollar? Well, if the US dollar is strong, then where do we make investments in the United States? So macro theory starts with an analysis of the globe and its growth. And then we distill it down to where it becomes micro, where, okay, if US is the leading economy, the dollar is the strongest and the tech sector is the best, how much of a bet do we make in that sector? And how do we counterbalance being in risky stocks with something more less risky or less? And that's the idea of, you're starting at what's happening in the world and bringing it all the way down to what's happening in your neighborhood. And that's what we do every day.
Okay. Now, okay. So with that in mind, and what would micro theory be is as a contrast, what are the people that are making decisions based on micro theory? What are they doing that differs from the macro approach?
So when you get down into micro, now it's the choice of, do I buy small caps today over large caps? So large caps, think of Microsoft, the biggest company in the world, or small caps, a local bank that you maybe never heard of in the South, maybe a Synovus Bank, a small cap regional bank. So between those two, where do I make the micro bet? And the micro bet's going to be based on, where is growth expanding in that sector? So are small companies doing better than large companies or vice versa? Okay. So micro analysis is, where are we from an economic growth standpoint? United States is based on the consumer. So is the consumer spending more money on large tech companies or at their local regional bank? That's micro. And one level below that, for certain investors, instead of buying a mutual fund or an ETF, I can explain what that is later, we'll buy a stock. So do we want to buy a stock that represents the smallest of companies, or do we want to buy Microsoft, which represents the largest? And that's the idea of going from global news and economic growth all the way down to looking what's happening in your local portfolio.
All right. So I had the opportunity last week. We spent some time together. Every year I look forward to getting your economic outlook for the year. You have themes that you kind of take on, maybe positions or attitudes, not so much predictions. So I'm hoping that maybe you can go through some of your themes for this year. I don't want to steal your thunder for future conference presentations, but maybe you can kind of give us a little preview of that.
No problem. The beauty of what Chris and I do is once we've crafted a portfolio, you know, we work together closely on some of these items, the fee structure allows us to make changes whenever need be. But you need a starting point. So a couple of things I want to walk you through the day in the life of how we work together and how I help build portfolios. We're a team of 19 here in New York City. Today, as I mentioned, manage a few dollars. So traditionally, most managers like myself will look at history as a starting point. And most will take 100 years of economic data and decide, let me build a portfolio based on that 100 years of data. We're not a big fan of that. We look at the last 10 years of data. And based on that last 10 years, that's our starting point. Then at the beginning of each year, we'll look at if we were going to build guardrails, kind of like when you're going down a highway and you don't want to bounce between the guardrails so you don't fall off the side of the highway, what would be our guardrails for the year? Now, it doesn't mean I can't change the portfolio or change what road I'm on. If I'm going straight on this road, I want to make a right to a different one because it's a faster, better way to get there. We do a lot of that. So our starting point for the year are the themes that Chris mentioned, and they're designed to give us a guardrail approach to where we want to be in the portfolio. And they're really pretty straightforward. One, we think the Federal Reserve is going to cut interest rates this year, but not early on. We don't think they're going to cut till later in the year. We think inflation is going to continue to fall and actually fall a bit faster than most expect. If you look at a factor called PCE, to give you a little bit of an insight into inside baseball, when you hear the chairman speak, he's speaking right now, actually, he'll talk about PCE, which is 148 different data points that tell us where real inflation is. Eggs, food, gas, oil, rent. And we look at that because that's more relevant to that headline CPI number. why. So when we look at something like that, and so that tells us that where inflation really is in the 6 months. But if you look back 3 months, 6 months, or 1 year ago, the 6 months number tells us inflation is falling pretty fast. So first, the Fed is going to cut rates eventually towards the end of the year. They're going to wait till inflation is falling fast enough, which sets us up for two really wonderful opportunities in the market. The third idea is we really like the bond market. You've noticed, I'm sure, in your local bank, you're getting CDs. You walk in, you see the sign, CDs for 4% or more. Mm-hmm. Same thing in the bond market. We could finally get not only get income, be paid the way around, but we could also get improvement in the price of a bond. And I'll explain what that means later. But the bond market's finally attractive again. And we think it's a great opportunity this year. We think small companies are actually going to do better than large companies this year, that we think small companies have in and of themselves a chance to really grow at a rapid rate once we get past sort of the turmoil of the election cycle, and as well as whether or not the United States falls into a recession. And then finally, when you put it all together, we think the United States is going to do pretty well this year, reflecting in a stock market that's going to do somewhere between 10 and 15% total growth. I'll split it down the middle and call it 12. Now, remember, we're already up just about 8 on the year. This week's been a little rough. Call it 7. So we're halfway there, and we're only in the month of March. So that means for the rest of this year, I think we're going to be trading a bit sideways. And there's a lot of reasons why. I can get into that as we go through it.
Okay. So then maybe start with the attractiveness of the bonds, because usually people don't, you know, they don't get excited about bonds, or bonds are sexy or something like that. So maybe elaborate that a little bit, where maybe people should be, I don't know about excited, but more hopeful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, depending how old you are, you might remember in the 80s, you had 15, 20% returns in income on your bond portfolio. And then we spent the better part of 40 years watching interest rates fall. Mm-hmm. That means the price of your bond went higher. Think of it this way. If you walked into a bank 6 months ago, and you bought a CD earning 5%, and you walked into a bank today and you bought a CD earning 4% because interest rates have come down a bit, which one would you rather have? Well, you certainly want the one that earns 5. So what happens in an environment like that, the one that earns 5 goes up in price because there's more demand for it, and their yield goes down because the yield is fixed. Conversely, if I buy the one that's 4% today, well, no one wants it. So what's it got to do? It's got to go on sale. Mm-hmm. So its price goes down, effectively making its yield go up. It's a seesaw relationship.
Yep.
What happens in an environment like this when we expect interest rates to fall? That's what the Fed wants. The Fed eventually gets its way. Interest rates today are 5.5%. As interest rates fall, bonds that are being issued today are going to be worth a heck of a lot more than bonds a year from now. Mm-hmm. So now we're buying lots of bonds. We're trying to buy bonds that have a maturity date, or what's called duration. Duration means the amount of time it takes to get my money back. So you bought the bond, and how long does it take to get my money back plus interest? So we want to buy bonds with duration that's about 10 years. And the reason why is, as interest rates fall, those are going to be the most valuable bonds. So not only are we getting a wonderful yield of 5 to 7%, we also got a chance for the price of the bond to go higher over the years to come. Well, that's the first time in 40 years. If you think about the last 10 years, really the last 7 specifically, interest rates have been stuck at 0.5%. So all bonds really were, to your point, Chris, was boring. But they did act as safety. In 2020, what was the best place to be early on when the pandemic hit? The bond market, because the places they were safe. At times when we get real turmoil, Russia invaded Ukraine, the bond market. If we get a significant recession around the United States, which it doesn't look like it right now, but if we did get one, because oil booms higher because of, once again, the Saudis, most Middle East and Russia are cutting back on production, trying to force oil higher. Well, then where do you want to be? The bond market. So now we went on two fronts. Not only do we get a wonderful yield and maybe price appreciation as the Fed eventually gets what it wants, we still get safety. So it's a real improvement over where we've been. And in fact, some history, remember, history is a starting point. We've never lost money 3 years in a row in the bond market. And if you remember, we lost money in 21, 22, we almost lost money in 23. But more importantly, never, not once, has the bond market lost money when the Federal Reserve starts cutting interest rates. And just this morning, the chairman has said, at some point, we will cut rates. Not yet. Later in the year, once they start to cut rates, the bond market looks even better. So the bond market is not only attractive from a safety standpoint, but from a total return standpoint.
Okay. Maybe. Yeah. And I get some questions right now, not as many, but I do get some questions right now about, are we out of the woods in terms of possibility of recession? Maybe you could comment on that, your opinion on that.
Let me tie inflation and recession together. The reason why you get inflation generally is because something has happened to be a stimulative in the economy. This time it's a bit different. The stimulant was excess money paid by the federal government. Traditionally, inflation is caused by we have a really strong economy for whatever the reason, and all we get lots of excess, people spending a lot and borrowing a lot. That wasn't the case this time. Inflation was caused by a supply shock. We just ran out of stuff because of the pandemic. So the government inflated the economy by pumping in $8 trillion in cash. Well, now that has taken a significant amount of time to unwind that cash. And truth be told, it hasn't totally unwound. There's still lots of cash sitting around in the system. It's better than where we were. And inflation was at 9.5%. Now it's arguably at 3. So it's come down, just not where the Federal Reserve wants it at 2. Now, why they wanted it at 2, separate discussion, maybe at the end for fun, we'll talk about it. But their ultimate goal is 2. So inflation still being high means the Federal Reserve wants it down. How do they get it down? They make interest rates, borrowing costs, high. So whether you're a company or you're just, you know, you run the local deli and you want to add on a new supply line and you want to borrow $100,000 to do that, it's going to cost you double the interest rate payment today than it did a few years ago. Think of it this way. If you went to buy a house today and your mortgage was 3 and now it's 7, obviously the increase in interest payments make it harder to buy that home. So you probably buy a smaller home. That's your recession. What happens in the economy is, well, as interest rates stay higher, corporations borrow money to grow. They're borrowing at a higher interest rate, which then puts pressure on how much they make, which then means they have to lay off some people to keep their profits high. So far, that hasn't happened, and that's what's called a soft landing. We've been able to get inflation lower, and corporations have hung in there actually quite well. Now, does the U.S. consumer also feel this fatigue? Of course. If you're borrowing money on credit cards or you're going to buy a house, you're paying a much higher interest rate. Yeah. But the little dirty secret about the U.S. economy that sometimes is overlooked is today, about 65% of the wealth is with people who are over the age of 65. Who, to be honest with you, wouldn't mind a good recession. Why? Because prices come down. Those folks are in excellent shape around the from the idea of their assets are at an all-time high. We've helped them grow their assets, you and I, and where you work with. But 401k assets, market, all that stuff's at an all-time high. Their house is worth more than it's ever been worth before. And yes, there is some inflation. Sure, go buy some eggs today. But they have enough capital to spend their way through it. So if you notice, go on an airplane, go on to a cruise, go on to a restaurant, they're all still very full. So right now, the idea of inflation coming down and U.S. consumer hanging on and corporations hanging on is happening. So tie it all together. Because inflation is slowly coming down, interest rates are supposed to come down, we should end up with a soft landing. There are three things that could cause a major recession. And those three are, one, oil, I mentioned already. But to the United States credit, we're producing more oil today than we ever have before. So that's a big plan, and more natural gas. Now, politics get in the way here. Folks, I don't play politics, don't care about politics, don't choose sides. They don't care Republican or Democrat. I can give you some stats around election years. But in the end, we have to make you all money based on what they do. And that's what we focus on. So politics and oil are mixed together. Today, we're back to levels we should be at. So I don't think that's we call those black swan events where something really bad can happen. But today, oil probably won't be the issue. It does mean inflation higher for longer because it's pushing back up on $80 a barrel, but we're keeping an eye on it. The second one is higher interest rates for longer tend to create breakage. And by that, I mean, let's say you're running a corporation and you took out, make it simple, $1 million loan 5 years ago. Now that $1 million and your interest rate was 3%. That $1 million loan comes due here and this year, and you have to refinance that $1 million loan because you still need the money, and you're going to refinance it at 7%, maybe 8%. Well, that increase puts so much pressure on your company that either you lay people off or you just go bankrupt.
Yeah.
Commercial real estate, for example. Today, New York City is only 52% occupied. And when you look at the enormity of the commercial real estate market, there's a small portion that's going to come due this year. And some of those loans are just going to default. So does it mean the big banks are going to get hurt or the small banks? So the higher rates for longer, and because the higher rates cause this cost to go higher, could create real breakage in the system. It hasn't happened yet. Something we're monitoring closely, and it's because so far we've hung in there. And it's number three that really is the driver here. Number three is the U.S. consumer has yet to feel the fatigue of higher interest rates. Buying a car, buying a house, credit card debt, so on, has not yet hurt the consumer from a spending standpoint. But you've noticed credit card debt's now over $1 trillion. Mm-hmm. And you see folks start to, especially the folks below $100,000, for every dollar they make, they're now spending it. So if one of those three breaks, then you got a catalyst for recession. I don't think they happen. So far, we've hung in there. The reason why, I'll go three back to one. The consumer hangs in there. Why? Because the labor market. The labor market's wonderful. This is the best labor market, I would argue, ever. For every person looking for a job, there's basically two jobs open. The average person got a significant wage over the last 3 years. That's inflationary, but I would argue the long-term effect over higher wages has finally lifted folks who make less than $100,000 to a much higher level. For example, those folks have $2.4 trillion more money today than they did pre-pandemic. And that's because they got higher wages and their assets are worth more. So everybody has been benefited by this idea of lifting off. It means higher inflation for longer, but so far, you got a good job. You got a wage increase. You're hanging in there just fine. To the consumer, no stress, especially the older folks who have a lot of money. Corporations, okay, as I mentioned already, still hanging in there. The debt issue, if interest rates come down, Fed wants them down, then that will alleviate that problem. Mm-hmm. And oil is a slippery slope. Today, the United States has very much come to the rescue of the rest of the world, especially Germany. Think of it this way, folks. Germany pays, we pay $2 a BTU for natural gas. Mm-hmm. Just for fun, Chris, what do you think Germany pays for per BTU, if you had to guess?
I know. Are they paying Russia or are they paying U.S.?
Paying U.S., they're paying Africa, the African continent.
I'll say 10.
Close, 18.
Okay.
So think of how inflationary that is for them. Now, what were they paying during when the war first happened? 36.
Yeah.
So it's come down, but nowhere near where we are. Mm-hmm. So today, because we have the ability, and we will send about 150 ships of natural gas, liquefied natural gas, to Germany this year. Algeria can do more. There's a number of countries who are doing this today. And that's that. My point is, it looks like there's a real effort to disenfranchise OPEC and Russia. Mm-hmm. And it's coming from South America, more production than ever. And it's coming out of Africa, more production than ever. Angola, for example, is a good example of a country who's very much online and producing significant more oil than ever expected before, and not an OPEC country. So I'm not worried about that black swan event, but you got to keep an eye on it because you just never know.
Yeah. Okay. So that, I think that kind of covers on a high level the potential obstacles or challenges that we could see from an economic standpoint. There's also on the flip side of that, some historical trends that are seen as possible positive indicators in the near term. So end of rate hikes, you kind of mentioned, election year, this being an election year, the end of interest rates hiking. So maybe go over though briefly what you see as the positive indicators going forward based on some historical trends.
A couple of things on our side. First of all, election years are good for markets. You go back to the 30s and the average rate of return is 9%. You go back to the 60s. So it's been 2 years where you lost money in election years. The average rate of return is around 12, almost 13%, 12 plus percent. When a sitting Democratic president elects another Democratic president, your return is about 11%. When a sitting Democratic president reelects a Republican president, it's about 13%. So in other words, pretty good. You're at, 90% of the time, a little bit better. You make money in election years. And when does it usually happen? In the fourth quarter. Mm-hmm. So I'll quote Yogi Berra. It's deja vu all over again. 2024, I think, will be a lot like 2023. By the way, if you haven't seen that documentary, it's unbelievable. If you get a chance, watch the Yogi Berra documentary. I never realized how his playing career was overshadowed so much by his personality. When you look at his career statistics, he's arguably one of the best baseball players that ever lived. It's certainly in the top five. His stats are incredible. Anyway, why I say it's deja vu all over again is because I think just like last year, we started off with a boom in the first 6 months. We have a very difficult summer. We rally sometime in October past election cycle. Fed starts to cut rates, and we have a wonderful November, December, January of the last few months going into the new year. Why is that? Well, because there's a lot of uncertainty in the marketplace around what the Fed's going to do, where we are from an inflationary standpoint, and how we ultimately tie out. But history's on your side. So that's point one. Mm-hmm. Point two, again, history, whenever the Fed starts to cut rates, in the 12 months after the first cut, normally stock market's up 12 to 14%, and that can continue up to 2 years after the first cut. So historically, and again, about 90% of the time, not 100% of the time like the bond market, but 90% of the time. So we've got a lot of things on our side that support that ability. One thing that's a bit unusual, remember, we had one heck of a year in 2023. Mm-hmm. Stock market was up, 26%. So we look at that number and go, whoa, wow, that's it. And by the way, the year before that, we had a really tough year, but still had multiple years in the last 10 with the average return of the stock market being 14%, almost double the historical average. So the stock's been on a tear for a long time here. So it wouldn't surprise me. That's, by the way, tie it back to the beginning. That's why I get to a plus 10 on the market this year, maybe a plus 12. Because we've had so many years of so much success. It's a bit like walking into a grocery store. When you walk in, folks, and you see your most expensive items, well, that's the big Magnificent Seven stocks that are really run up in price. And while they're great companies, and you might like that cereal on the top shelf, that's your favorite cereal, but now most popular and tastes the best, but certainly the most expensive, you might want to look for something a little cheaper in the middle shelf or down on the bottom, simply because not as many folks want it, but it's cheaper. That's kind of today's stock market, that it's had one heck of a run. The biggest names have dominated the stock market. All the other names haven't caught up yet. And this year is going to be a lot about pivoting to other names that need to catch up in performance to where those Magnificent Seven have worked.
Okay. And I've also heard some statistic on when the month of January is positive. That's can be an historical indication on how the rest of the year will go. Do you know anything about that, Phil?
I do. It's the January effect. Okay. And generally, it's usually, believe it or not, it's first 2 weeks of the year are the most important. And okay. They turn out to be positive 1%. As long as okay. They're positive. When they're positive 7 or 8, it's much better. The positive one usually bodes for about 80% of the time the market seems to be positive. Those kind of acronyms I don't love. The selling
sure.
away right. acronyms, another one that's yeah. been out there for a long time. Well, let's tie this back to the beginning. Remember, as I mentioned earlier, that the way Chris and I work with you, it's on a structure where we can buy and sell and never have cost you any money. We set those guardrails up in the beginning. Along the year, we make changes to the portfolio based on how the economic environment has changed. So I'm a little less worried about May and January and selling, but I do focus on what's the opportunity set based on where the year is trending economically. Is it time to add more small caps to the portfolio because we're growing better as an economy? Is it time to take our 10-year bonds and go back to 5-year bonds because interest rates have flattened out? Things like that are much more important to us in keeping an eye on where we're going rather than sort of those trends of history data points, which aren't yeah. really that factual, just a trend.
Right.
We use it as a starting point. We pay attention to it, but it's certainly not an end point.
Okay. So that kind of segues into the next thing that I wanted to ask you about. You know, most of the people that we work with, they are delegating responsibility of their money management and money management and their financial affairs to us to help them, give them advice that's in their best interest. So I'm curious on your side, what you kind of believe to be the biggest factor is investment-wise or financial-wise for people trying to plan for a comfortable environment. I see that Don't Panic book behind you. So I don't know if that's on purpose or not.
That is.
But, okay. So maybe that doesn't have to be your answer, but I'm just kind of curious what your take is on that, Phil.
Two easy answers to this one. First off, I wrote the foreword for that book. It's kind of a fun book about history. And why I keep it up there is what happens in election years? Folks get so entangled into who the next president is going to be. I'll give you a dirty secret, everybody. President has almost no impact on economics.
Right.
Economics and presidencies, they're just not really tax policy. Okay, sure. Yeah. You know, where we're going as the long term trend of tax policy, the long term trend of military and government spending, the long term trends of where we are from a social economic standpoint. Yeah, okay. But month over month, quarter over quarter, not so much. Really, our economy is cyclical. It ebbs and flows like the tide. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you know, when I think about the things that get folks emotional, they panic. Mm-hmm. Classically, investors tend to buy at the high and sell at the low. FOMO, fear of missing out. And this market has been beneficial for all the FOMO folks. Think about Bitcoin. It just keeps going higher. And for the life of me, I don't know why, but we could talk about that separately. But my point is, you know, the lessons of investing are quite simple. One, don't panic. And two, risk plus time equals reward. It's just that simple. Mm-hmm. If you said to Chris and I, hey, this money's for my grandkids and I want to get above average rate of return, we're going to go buy your stocks because we know we have at least 10 years or more to do that. If you said, hey, this money is for my cruise next year, and I want to go out and, you know, enjoy myself without using a lot of my principal, great. We'll go build you a safe bond portfolio that's earning 5% right now and get you there. So I think that sometimes we forget about the power of compound investing and time. All the market needs is time. Over history, the stock market's doubled the bond market. In short-term environments, the bond market's done better than the stock market in times of volatility. So what's my motto? If risk plus time equals reward, then the second part, just lose less when markets are down. If you want to look at us, a performer, and Chris can show you our performance and why we work together, we've classically, in our track records in some cases, go back as much as 20 years, that we've consistently lost less when markets are down. How do we do that? A diversified portfolio that has both bonds, some alternative investments, things that zag when the market zigs, and being smart about keeping money in stocks, but in the safer type of stocks rather than taking a lot of risk in. So the easy answer, everybody, if you're patient and you tell Chris what you need from a reward standpoint, we can get you there.
Yeah. Okay. And then kind of, I guess, along that line, a lot of the portfolios you build are incorporating either mutual funds or ETFs in them. So for the everyday investor, which is primarily who we work with Main Street, we find that, you know, managed money products like ETFs and mutual funds are very, very appropriate. Maybe just quickly contrast those between individual stocks. It's not that individual stocks are bad per se, but with some particular ETFs, you're getting a lot of diversification and exposure to those things without concentrating in a particular company. A
couple of ways to look at it. For the average investor who doesn't have $100,000, it's really hard to go out and buy enough stocks to run a $100,000 portfolio that's going to be diversified and cover little asset classes. So to Chris's point, we can buy one ETF for $1,000 that would cover broad markets. So the ETF and mutual fund business was born of for the small investor that wants access to markets. And what we've realized over years, as things evolve, certain times it makes sense to use a mutual fund. For example, the municipal bond market. I really like mutual funds versus an ETF. By the way, an ETF is a basket of securities that traditionally doesn't have a portfolio manager. It's just created and then replicates an index, for example, the S&P 500 or whatever you want to do it. Usually because there's no portfolio manager, it's much lower in costs. So for example, the average mutual fund expense is called 0.75. The average ETF can be 0.5. And I'm making, I'm giving generalities.
Yep.
So think about starting the 50-yard dash on the 25-yard line. If you're paying less fees, you're making more money. So traditionally, I really like ETFs for a number of reasons. One, they have very little tax impact. It's a more complicated conversation, but they don't tend to distribute capital gain. And two, they have lower fees. So for some investors, especially taxable accounts, I think it's very smart to use an ETF, especially smaller accounts. Where a mutual fund, it's interesting, especially in places where we require high activity, for example, small cap accounts, small cap stocks, mid cap stocks, certain types of bond investments, certain higher risk corporate bonds, where you want a portfolio manager who's actively analyzing the investments to make sure that they are the best investments for today. Whereas an ETF, you buy it, you set it, you forget it. Mutual funds, now there's a higher cost though. If we're paying a portfolio manager to run that mutual fund, it's a higher cost of doing it. By the way, a mutual fund means everybody who's in it mutually owns it. So you and I are in a mutual fund, you and I mutually own it together. If everybody on this call owned it, then we all mutually own it together. It means we all share an expense. We also own the share in the capital gain. We all share in paying the portfolio manager. An ETF's not like that. ETF's basically replicating an exchange. It's not mutual. It's a little bit like owning a stock. You buy it, you set it, you forget it. So both have their advantages. It depends on your taxes, the size of your portfolio, and ultimately what your goal is. Can contrast to stocks, we still buy a lot of stocks, but we do that for folks that have more than $1 million. And the reason why we do that, it's even more tax efficient. So we can get greater performance because we're going to have a much more concentrated portfolio, more volatility, by the way,
right?
Less risk, more ups and downs, but better long-term results. We can also buy real bonds. A mutual fund never matures. An ETF never matures. When we're buying bonds, if I can buy you a real Florida bond that's going to have a guaranteed rate of return, then regardless of interest rates going lower or higher, you're going to get that income and you're going to get your money back. So depending on your size, your time, your risk, and your tax efficiency or awareness, it depends on which portfolio is right for you.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. I want to switch gears just a little bit. I do consider you one of the most optimistic people that I know in general. So I'm curious just kind of what gives you that hope, what that inspiration. I mean, you're a big believer in capitalism and the markets, the U.S. economy, kind of humanity itself, not to get existential, but maybe just expand on that.
So it starts with my background. You know, when watching immigrants come and build a life, my father's the most successful man I've ever known. No education, and passed away recently, and net worth was in excess of $3.5 million, something like that, almost $4 million. And that to me is where my dad was the optimist. My father and mother both loved the United States because it gave them everything that they wanted. And I am a historian by my inner self. I love history. So when I look at history of markets and you tie it together with optimism, my glass is always half full. Why? Because for every down year, there's three positive years in the stock market. On average, the bond markets only lost money a handful of times in 100 years. So why not be an optimist when the history certainly tells you you should be? Then I switched to capitalism. And So if my optimism is born of success in markets over time, what I've seen it do 34 plus years doing this, how much money folks can make by being optimistic and staying invested for the long term and how much can make them. But then when I come back to who we are as a country, you know, there's three tenets of capitalism that are extremely powerful that you probably never think about. For all the, you know, everything can, every model, every type of government can be tweaked from time to time. Capitalism is no different. But there are three things that make us so unique and powerful that I think sometimes we forget about them. And the first one is, believe it or not, bankruptcy rights. We are the only country in the world that has traditional bankruptcy rights outside of the UK to a much lesser degree. Why that matters is you and I can have a brilliant idea, go find some investors, go build it, hire a bunch of folks. And if it doesn't work out, then the investors lose money, but the folks don't necessarily have to, and we can start all over again. And bankruptcy rights allow capitalism to continually reinvent itself. Whereas in Europe, or most of the rest of the world, they're stuck on companies that should be out of business, should go away. But because of labor unions and investment rights, they don't. So it creates a drag. The second one now is kind of with that, patent rights. You want to know the real core of capitalism? Patent rights. Patent rights allow you to have an idea and own it. Just think of Microsoft. Just think of Facebook, Meta.
Yeah.
You know, Mark Zuckerberg's a multi-billionaire today. Amazon, Jeff Bezos is now the richest man in the world again. They have the patents on what they built. Tesla, same thing. So patent rights, which exist nowhere else in the world and in a much lesser degree the UK, allow us to continually rebuild and reinvent capitalism. That's the second one. The third one, obviously, immigration. That you have immigration as this incredibly powerful stimulant to rejuvenate your workforce. Today, 70% of our economy is built on the U.S. consumer. That consumer today, from a demographic standpoint, we have about 30% in the lowest, youngest generation, 30% in the middle, and about 30% in the older, with on the fringes, you know, a few more or less depending on year. In other words, our demographic pyramid is flat. Brilliant. You look at every other developed country in the world, it's inverted. The oldest folks make up the top of the pyramid and the youngest the most. Why? Because high taxes, poor economies, and low growth. Well, guess what? We win because of immigration. No one else in the world really has immigration the way we do. Now, I'm not going to touch legal and illegal. I'll let you all fight that out. That's not my ballgame. Right. We just have a workforce that continually rebuilds itself today. You know, the millennial generation is having more than two babies per family. No one saw that coming. So it's a very powerful stimulant. And it's a fourth one, which I wouldn't call it a benefit to capitalism, but we're the unintended superpower. Why? We got more fresh water than really any other country on the planet. We're surrounded by water on almost all sides. Obviously, Canada having this tremendous northern border, but it's landlocked to a great degree. So yeah, we're protected by land and sea, and we have lots of natural commodities. So for me, my optimism is born of history of markets. I know what they can do. And what makes capitalism in of itself at its core successful for everybody. Now, I know it's not perfect. I get that. But I would argue the last couple of years are indicative of how powerful capitalism can be while the rest of the world is really struggling. Think about what's Germany, Europe, Japan, China. China, for example, everyone thought China was going to take over the United States. By the way, a little secret, everybody. When someone says China is a better country, a stronger country, you're going to replace us as the dollar or owns our debt, that person's a moron. Don't talk to that person. Change the channel or run, because that's completely made up to scare you. China will never be bigger than the United States. It'll never take over our debt. It doesn't own our debt. You, American citizens, own our debt. We own 70% of our debt. China owns 6. Japan owns more than China. So when people say that, it's to scare you and make you watch TV, some joker like me on TV telling you what's real and what's not.
Okay. Well, and I guess what have they said before, which is it's not a perfect system, right? But of all the systems that are available that you could use, it is the most, it's the perfect of the imperfects, right? It's the best choice of all the choices, especially with everybody having the opportunity to rise up, right? And having the opportunity to do that, where that certainly isn't the case in a lot of the other systems. I'm not talking about the dictatorships, but just even the other systems that are used. Okay. Yeah.
And I'll say this. I know a lot of folks are worried about our debt. That's an ongoing perpetual conversation. And you're right. Our debt has now accumulated to a level that we haven't seen since World War II. And there's two ways you fix a scenario like this. You end up creating new revenue. Chris is probably more in tune to this than even I am. at the end of 2025, the Trump era tax cuts as of now will sunset. Mm-hmm. It means an increase in taxes across the board, which helps bring down your debt. And the other side is reduced spending. And you're seeing spending come down quite significantly, not to where we want it to be. I happened to be at a luncheon with Chairman Powell recently, and his point was, today we can manage our debt. We are on an unsustainable path. So you would hope that the folks in power will be able to, in the spending on both the Senate and the Congress, will make a decision to spend a bit less, get us back to where we, for every dollar we make, we owe a dollar. Today, for every dollar we make, we owe about $1.10. Europe owes $1.50. China owes $1. For every dollar China makes, it owes about $2.50. For every dollar Japan makes, owes about $2.25, by the way. Mm. So, you know, when you look at it, we're the best house in a bad neighborhood, to put it mildly, when it comes to debt. But we have the deepest pools. We have the deepest economy in the world, the most diversified economy in the world, far and away the biggest in the world. So we can manage this debt today. What's the downside of all this debt? The federal government made interest payments, just like if you took out a mortgage on a house, what your interest payments are, of $380 billion in 2019. Mm. Just for fun, Chris, you know, what do you think it'll be by the end of this year?
Mm.
Wild shot in the dark.
$700 billion?
You're close. It was $700 at the beginning. It'll probably close at the end of the year at $800 billion. That's a lot of money. So what does that mean? If the federal government spending more money on interest payments, it's spending less on defense, new projects, ideas. That takes the second most powerful stimulant out of the U.S. economy. That's your real problem. Yeah. And by the way, the path we're on, if we don't get our debt under control and we don't get interest rates down, it'll grow to $1.5 trillion by early 2030, 2031. Mm. That's an incredible amount of money. So if that's the case, now you're talking a significant headwind to growth in the United States, and that's a problem. So I don't disagree with the debt concerns. It's not a today issue. It's a concern for today. You can't continue, but it's not breaking the U.S. economy as of now. It could, though. I jokingly call it the Dante's Inferno. Remember that book we read in high school?
Yeah.
It's level one. It's of the rings of hell. It's level one. If you don't get this right, the more debt you add, the more interest payments you make, mm-hmm. even more limited growth you have, and you begin to look like Europe or Japan, for that matter.
It's a spiral.
It's a spiral. Exactly.
Okay. All right. We're going to pause and see if we have any questions from any of the attendees today. I sent a little message out. If anyone has a question for Phil, you can type that into the chat and I'll bring that to his attention and we can go over those things. So now's the Q&A part. If anyone has any questions, go ahead and do that. We'll pause for a few seconds, see if anything shows up.
We've bored them to tears, my friend.
No. We just covered everything. We've covered every possible question that someone could have. We've addressed it.
Yeah, that's what it is. You and I can't shut up.
Which is my approach, right?
We could talk more about Italian soccer. Yeah, I get your sons on. We'll talk more about Italian soccer.
Yeah, that's right. They were just talking about who was in good form and who wasn't, which teams were in good form and which ones weren't.
You can tell them I'm going to be seeing Fabio Cannavaro soon. He's a friend of mine. They'll know who he is. He's a former captain of the Italian national team.
Okay, last call for any questions for anybody, any of the participants. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay.
We have one.
Aha. Uh-huh. All right. Let's see here.
Go ahead. You should check it out.
Oh, yeah. So we have a question about someone would like Phil's opinion on the Bitcoin hype and the ETFs that just came about, that just got created, that are giving people exposure to the Bitcoin or the digital currency environment.
So I have fun with this topic. And to be clear, we are not recommending you buy Bitcoin. We're not saying you should or should not. This is just our opinion on the product. The digital age, the crypto age, is a fascinating one. The ability to move information, data, money in a moment's notice is incredible. And to do it in a way that's somewhat unhackable is pretty powerful. So there is something here in the crypto world that makes sense. Where I struggle is, one, its perception of value, and two, whether or not it'll ever be a currency. And I'll make these relatively quick. I do not think it ever becomes a currency. And I know that's contrarian to what a lot of folks think. And the reason why is, it's not that it couldn't be. If you had the right regulations, the right protocols in place, the right safety mechanism, sure. But why would any country in the world, whether it's China, Japan, Europe, or the United States, ever give up the ability to create and manipulate its own currency? The federal government's not, basically, if you had Bitcoin, you would eliminate the Federal Reserve. So that power is not going away. That's why I don't think it ever becomes a legal tender. So I'd go one further with that as well. I could see them restricting it from being a tender going forward, like China already has done. Now, will the federal government ever go crypto digital? Be careful. What happens today when every single dollar you have is now digital and your complete privacy is gone? So it has opened up Pandora's box. The other thing about Bitcoin that I find fascinating is it's a little bit like gold. There's a perception of value here. And the perception of value in Bitcoin today is that fiat currencies, traditional developed currencies, are printing money endlessly and they're worthless. Whereas Bitcoin has a limited supply. By 2040, the last coin will come into the market. By the way, coin, it's not a real coin. It's a fragment of code on the internet that's pieced together to create a series of codes. And it was buried there by some guy in Japan, maybe four guys or one guy, we're not sure, who doesn't want to be like, give us his name. So that's kind of in and of itself, the history of Bitcoin is quite unusual and speculative. But my point is, since there's a limited supply, it's got a perception of value. The perception, whether it's a piece of jewelry that you wear that has a piece of, that you have perceived it to be more or less, is no different than anything else. Now, dollar is backed by the U.S. economy, where Bitcoin is not backed by anything. So the ETFs have simply made the process of buying and selling significantly more efficient. And the beauty of that is like gold. Remember when gold, you can only buy it at your local bank and have to keep it. Right? When gold became an ETF, it made the process much simpler. So the ETFs have made the process of being in Bitcoin simpler, and it's pushed it to all-time highs. Today, we broke an all-time high at 69,000 for a blink of an eye here. So it means that more folks are in it forever. What I'm a little worried about is one of these ETFs ever gets hacked, and the actual coins that they have to back up their ETF is stolen. They're not traceable. So that's one protocol I hope they have ironed out. But secondly, I think it's fascinating. It's a very interesting marketplace. I think if you want to be in it, you think about where these things are going to be bought and sold. Places like Coinbase are an interesting idea to me, the actual exchange where they trade on. Again, not a recommendation. But I would say, you know, the future of crypto is in play here. Now it's become easier to buy and sell. Before you make an investment here, understand it's still highly speculative as its long-term use, what the regulatory environment will look like, how it's taxed, by the way, and whether or not it's safe. So if I were going to make any recommendation, I'd say, be careful about how much you put in something like this. Although, in fairness, one last point, it's the single best performing asset class over the last 10 years, up over 9,000% in the last 10 years. So there's something here. I'm not sure we've nailed it down just yet.
Yeah. But I think I saw a quote in one of the Forbes magazines or something, adjusted for inflation, I think it stated that gold has about the same relative value that it did in the Roman era. Adjusting for. So that's just kind of interesting that giving that context. Okay, we have a second question. These are all the hot questions today that we're getting. So is AI, artificial intelligence, impacting the economy or the market now? Is it impacting it now, or will it in the future?
Great question. We have been dealing with computer algorithm in the stock market for decades. This is really not new for us. So now the improvement on the algorithm with AI may happen. AI is an interesting idea. I do think it has a long-term play. I think it's going to be profoundly impactful in the medical industry to get conclusions faster. Yeah. The problem is there's already a number of data sets that are being pumped into AI that are fraudulent. So the AI is built to take in data that will then give you a much more sophisticated or much more applicable answer. But if the data it takes in is fraudulent, then you've got a bigger problem in your hand. And I think when it comes to the stock market, we're going to be overrun with bad data. It was our, we've seen it in algorithms for years where one day they work and one day they don't. So I'm not convinced it's going to have a profound impact on the markets yet. Over time, for sure, I do think it's about data in, data out. Getting clean data is going to make AI more effective. And today we don't have clean data. So today we are aware of it. We recognize it. It's a trend. It'll probably make us more efficient, but it's certainly not anywhere near where we're using it today to make investment decisions because I'm concerned about its output and how accurate it is.
Yeah, and I think to piggyback on that, we should look at it as a helpful efficiency tool, but not a source of data that you make decisions based on, right? Because everyone's assuming, oh, okay, well, if it's on the internet or if it's on this AI site, then it's true. You're saying we can't assume that. And like I've told my kids a lot when they're giving an effort in their homework or something, if crap goes in, your effort, then you're probably going to get crap out.
Exactly.
Okay. Any other questions from the audience? Anybody else? Anything? We'll wait a few seconds here in case those are all good questions. Thanks, everybody, for those.
They are good questions. Thank you. And thank you
for the potential. We have an informed audience, a perceptive audience.
I can see that.
Yeah, we'll see how our night group does. For anybody who's not available or wants to come back, or we are doing a 6 o'clock session too. Phil and I will be on again at 6 o'clock tonight.
Yeah, you can go figure out your questions, come back, and we'll take them tonight.
That's right. Yes, yes. And you can type those in the chat. Perfect. Okay, looks like we're good on that. So, Phil, listen, I want to thank you for taking the time to be here with me today. It's been a pleasure. And I want to thank everybody that was in attendance today for tuning into our inaugural Economic Outlook session brought to you by LPF Advisors, where, of course, we're helping to try to raise the financial confidence and knowledge of everyday people to another level, one client at a time. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Phil, thanks for being here. It was my pleasure. All right, everybody, take care.
You've been listening to the Confident Retirement Podcast with Chris and Mark from LPF Advisors. For more information on them and retiring confidently, please visit lpfadvisors.com. If your ears are pleased and your mind is now at ease, do share the program with your friends and subscribe wherever podcasts are found.